Did you know there are three foundations you need to handle in order to have optimal brain health and wellness? We'll dive into those today.
I'm Dr. Shabnam Das Kaur, a functional medicine doctor. I teach people how to improve their focus, get rid of brain fog, and reduce the risk of dementia down the line.
And I'm Andrea Spiros. I'm a professional speaker, and I work with organizations to harness the power of high-powered habits to increase engagement, resilience, and well-being. We're also Tiny Habits coaches who can help you design the habits that will get you the results you want. If you're not familiar with the Tiny Habits method, check out our short episode explaining how it works. The link will be in the show notes. So, what are the three foundations of brain health? They are optimal blood glucose, optimal blood pressure, and low inflammation. Dr. Shabnam, can people really improve their brain health if they only focus on these three things?
The fact is, these three are, as you pointed out, the foundations. So optimal blood glucose levels, even if you do not have diabetes, are extremely important for long-term brain health. And optimal blood pressure levels and low levels of chronic inflammation. Now, the fact is, you know, brain health is not different from heart health or health in general. So the most important thing to focus upon is if you have these three things well managed, then definitely you have a great start to the rest of your any other areas of your health. But these are not the only three things, but these are extremely important.
So it sounds like these are a great foundation for your brain health. And I think that's why you call them the three foundations of brain health. If people just get started in these three areas, they're going to set their health on a much better trajectory. So let's talk about the first one, optimal blood pressure. Tell us a little bit about what it is and why it's important.
So blood pressure is actually something that, you know, people, when you have hypertension, you go to a doctor, your blood pressure is checked, and your doctor says you have hypertension. And usually your doctor would recommend, depending on what your blood pressure is and your age, your doctor would recommend some medications or lifestyle changes. Now, the fact is, there are lots and lots of studies which show us that having blood pressure in a certain range is extremely important for preventing cognitive decline. Now, the fact is, you know, having a higher blood pressure reduces blood supply to the brain, and it also causes, so the underlying problem of high blood pressure, we don't know the exact cause, and there is no one single cause. There are multiple causes, but one of the problems is a problem in the blood vessels itself. And again, you know, our bodies are network of networks. So blood pressure, blood glucose, chronic inflammation, all the three things are intimately related. Now, when it comes to blood pressure, one of the biggest challenges with having high blood pressure is most people don't know they have hypertension because people with hypertension don't have any symptoms. Now, that does not mean that hypertension does not cause any symptoms in anyone. Some people may experience headaches, but most of the time, they don't experience anything. So the only time it is diagnosed is when it is measured. Now, unfortunately, what happens is a lot of young people have hypertension. Young hypertension is becoming extremely common now all over the world. And even hypertension in children. So the unfortunate thing is most people are not aware of their blood pressure and they don't know that it is causing problems in the background. And unless you go to the doctor or you have a blood pressure instrument at home or you have, nowadays we also have some wearable devices which can measure blood pressure. So that is one of the first important things. And more importantly, all over the world, even people who have hypertension, many of them don't have it under good control. And there are various reasons for it. Maybe we'll do a deeper dive into hypertension on another episode.
Sounds good.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit more about what the complications or the problems are with having high blood pressure, and then what should we do about it? Should everyone go out right now and go get their blood pressure checked, or how should they handle it effectively?
So what happens with hypertension is number one is hypertension by itself, even if you don't have stroke. So it raises your risk for stroke. And stroke, as we know, is one of the major things which contribute to dementia, cognitive decline down the line. So stroke is basically blood supply to a certain part of the brain gets interrupted. And the brain is that area of the brain may, again, I don't want to get into all the complications, but that area of the brain does not function optimally, and all the and a lot of things can happen. And again, depends on how soon you get the treatment. So one is hypertension increases your risk for stroke. Hypertension increases your risk for a whole host of heart diseases like, heart failure and all those things. And most importantly, hypertension, unless it is controlled well, also raises your risk for poor blood supply to the brain, as I've mentioned before. So these are the primary ones. Sorry, go ahead.
And that sounds like it's going to contribute to brain fog and maybe some memory issues and other things like that. So it's really important that people have optimal blood pressure and get it checked regularly.
Yes, and another important thing which people don't always think of is hypertension is also related to sexual dysfunction. So men may have erectile dysfunction, women may have, other sexual issues as well. And very often they are not thinking of hypertension as the causative agent. So in my world of functional medicine, Andrea, there is one thing we talk about. Erectile dysfunction is ED. So one ED is related to another ED. The another ED is endothelial dysfunction, which means endothelium is the single layer of cells in the blood vessels. So if the point is, sometimes people make fun of things like erectile dysfunction or any of these things, but erectile dysfunction is a very important, biomarker, we would say, to get yourself screened for heart disease and, of course, hypertension as well. So I just wanted to, because that is not something that people talk about often. So that is something very important to keep in mind. If you, now, these are not the only causes for erectile dysfunction, but if you have that problem, make sure that you talk to your doctor about it. And, it should not be made into a joke, Oh.
Exactly. And it does sound like too that one symptom can be illuminating of something bigger going on in the body. So it's really important to take that seriously and get that checked out, and knowing that this could be a symptom of high blood pressure, because you want to address the real issue, not just something that a symptom that's come from that.
Yes, and also diabetes. So a lot of people with diabetes have erectile dysfunction, and then of course there could be medications as well. But the point that we want to highlight is if you have erectile dysfunction, you need to, meet your doctor and discuss what could be the possible causes.
Now, do you have any resources for people so that they can have some notes on optimal blood pressure?
Yes, definitely. So we will do a deeper dive into blood pressure. What are the optimal levels? Because so a few years ago there was a very landmark study in the hypertension world called the SPRINT trial. So there was a SPRINT MIND trial as well, where they found that having blood pressure and in the range of 120 by 80 is optimal. Now I have to put in a lot of caveats there because it depends on your age as well. And most importantly, it also depends on how you achieve those lower numbers. So in medicine, Andrea, it's so easy to give you to prescribe two more medications because it is way easier to take a pill than to make a lot of the lifestyle changes that we will talk about. But as a functional medicine doctor, maybe the other thing is the patients who come to me or doctors like me are looking for what they'll call a more natural approach. Now, that does not mean that I would not recommend someone takes medications to lower
Sure,
pressure, but
sure.
it will depend on their age because the fact is, it's not just important to have a lower blood pressure if you are, you're having lower blood pressure when you stand up. and then you just fall and have a head trauma because of that. Or you have electrolyte imbalances because of the two additional medications I've added, versus how I look at, you know, hypertension management would be, the first and foremost goal is to get you to your optimal levels. And that depends on all these different factors. The next is how we get there. So things like, you know, sleep, deep sleep is one of the best antihypertensives. So how I would look at someone, you know, with hypertension is I would focus on their sleep if they are not sleeping well. Then the other things, like, of course, salt is an important thing, but there are also certain supplements, and we'll go into all these in details on our episode on hypertension. But the important thing to remember is, what is your optimal level and how are you achieving that? For some people, Andrea, it's, you know, it may involve in adding two other medications, but also at the same time, it's important to know what the side effects are. And of course, you know, in health, as in everything else, you get to decide. So one point I want to make is, if you are someone who has hypertension and you are on three medications to manage your blood pressure better, you should not feel guilty that you are not able to manage it more naturally. So I have a lot of patients, Andrea, who will say, oh, doctor, I don't want to add one more medication. I want to try some more time with natural therapies. But I always have to tell them, don't feel guilty about not being able to, because natural therapies take much longer. Weight loss is another big one, which reduces blood pressure. But as you know, weight loss is not a simple thing.
Exactly. And I think that the permission you're giving people to explore the variety of options that work for them, and also to take the medication when it's necessary, because getting your blood pressure under control in the first place gives you a better brain to then deal with it in complementary ways, right? There, you're not going to have the brain power to do what you need to do and think critically about your situation if you're running around with high blood pressure. And it's not, exactly. It's not safe either. It's not safe either. So let's get yourself safe. Let's talk about, and we will do a deeper dive on this in the future, but let's talk about the next bit, which is optimal blood glucose levels.
Okay. So we know that we have lots and lots of studies that people who have diabetes are at a much higher risk for cognitive decline. They are much higher risk for mental health conditions like more depression. But a lot of studies have focused nowadays on having less than optimal blood glucose levels. And I'm going to talk about levels very soon. And particularly, a lot of studies are coming up now which show that having less than optimal blood glucose levels in your middle ages. So most people think of cognitive decline, dementia as a problem which happens only in older people. But the fact is, dementias, particularly like Alzheimer's disease, and there are a whole bunch of other dementias as well, it starts 20 to 30 years before someone actually develops symptoms. So therefore, middle age health is extremely important for long-term health. And you and I have talked about this before, Andrea. When is the best time to focus on your brain health? Like, it's any day. Like today, whether you are in your 20s, whether you're a teenager. Actually, as a former OBGY, I say you should start thinking before, you know, you plan your pregnancy.
I think we were saying that the best time to think about your health was a few years ago, but the second best time is today. So yes. Really, if you're starting today, you're at the perfect place at the perfect time, and we've got the information to help you make the changes that you need to do.
Blood glucose levels, what are these newer studies showing? Many of them have shown that if your blood glucose levels, fasting blood glucose levels, are higher than 4.9 millimoles per liter, so that's the Canadian unit. Those of you who are used to nanograms, that would be about 85 to 90. If your fasting blood glucose levels are there or higher, you are still not diagnosed as having type 2 diabetes, but you are still not at optimal health. And that is something very important because, Andrea, I find a lot of people, you know, when they go to their doctor, they have their annual checkup and their blood glucose levels are higher than optimal. And their doctor will tell them, oh, you don't have diabetes today, but you need to watch your blood glucose. Now, what is going to happen by watching them? I don't know. You definitely need a strategy to manage them better.
Exactly, but, exactly.
So the important question is, what does, you know, glucose do for the brain, since we're talking about brain health here? Now, our brains are just 2% of our body weight, but the brain uses up 20% of our daily energy requirement. So I always talk about the brain being a huge energy hog. Another energy hog is our immune system, but we'll talk about the immune system some other day. So your brain is just 2% of your body weight, uses up 20% of your energy. The important thing to focus on is, yes, the brain uses glucose for its energy requirements, for all the wonderful things it has to do. But a lot of studies are showing nowadays, in fact, some people consider Alzheimer's disease to be type 3 diabetes or diabetes of the brain. So basically what happens is the brain loses its ability to use glucose as a fuel. But again, we have studies supporting that. The brain is still able to use other substances like ketones as a fuel. So, Andrea, is this sounding very complicated? I'll try to simplify.
So let's talk a little bit about, when you talk about glucose, what you're talking about is what people might think of as sugars, and not just sugar, table sugar, but sugars in the food. And when you're talking about ketones, you're talking about fats and other things. And so when your body, normally the body uses glucose very, the brain uses glucose very efficiently to fuel it. But when you don't have optimal blood glucose levels, your brain loses that ability. And that can contribute to brain fog, all the brain related diseases like Alzheimer's in the future as well. Correct?
That is correct. And the other important thing is, because the brain uses glucose, you'll sometimes find people talking about, so glucose is essentially, like you said, sugar. So sugar is, that is table sugar, is a combination of glucose and fructose. And all the other carbohydrates that become sugar, so things like, you know, pasta, rice, all the grains, also, you know, so basically the starchy food. Then also, you know, starch is present in vegetables as well. So things like potatoes. But again, the amount of carbohydrate present in them varies. So something like broccoli has very little carbohydrate in it versus something like white potatoes. So not just table sugar, which everybody knows is not, you know, too much of it is not good for you, but also things that become sugar in your body, like carbohydrate containing food. One important thing which I hear a lot of people talking about is, your brain needs glucose to function, so you need to eat carbohydrates. This is where I want to, you know, highlight. Yes, your brain needs glucose, but our bodies have the ability to make glucose from other things, which means glucose or carbohydrate-containing food are not essential nutrients. Essential nutrients are food that our bodies don't have the ability to make. So therefore, we need to have them as food. And some people would also need supplements. Whereas, so broadly, if we look at food in general, we look at macronutrients, protein, carbohydrate, fat. So carbohydrates are not essential nutrients, whereas proteins are made of amino acids, and some of them are essential, and some fats like omega-3 fatty acids. And we'll talk about all these in details in later episodes.
Exactly, exactly. And so to be very clear, if you're listening, that what Shabnam is saying is not that you don't eat carbohydrates. There's not a push here to go on a high protein, zero carbohydrate diet. but it is to put it in perspective that if you don't have optimal blood glucose levels, tracking it is important, but also understanding how food affects that and how it can affect your brain is important as well. And I think a lot of people out there, because there's so the diet industry around the world is so huge, there's a lot of conflicting information. And so Dr. Shabnam is here to share the science-based bits of this so that you can make informed decisions for yourself. So anything else to wrap up blood glucose before we move on to inflammation?
No, most importantly, like I said, what are the optimal numbers for you? And again, like blood pressure, if you have diabetes, and none of, you know, whatever Andrea and I are talking about here is medical advice, you need to talk to your healthcare professional for that. But there is a lot you can control. And the interesting thing is, you know, which is the complicated thing as well, is a lot of your blood glucose levels is related to your food. And we are going to talk about, you know, food. It's not just what you eat, it's also when you eat. But we are going to do deep dives into all of that.
Exactly. We're just giving you the basic information today. And everything that we talk about on this podcast and in future podcasts really is to empower you so that you understand what's important, why it's important, and then you can formulate the questions to your healthcare provider so that you can be empowered to take the actions that are right for you, whether it's natural solutions, whether it's diet and exercise related, or whether it's actual medication. We want you to be able to get the help that you need that is appropriate for you.
Yes.
So let's talk about the third foundation. We've talked about optimal blood pressure. We've talked about optimal blood glucose levels. Now let's talk about the third foundation of brain health, chronic inflammation.
So chronic inflammation is actually related to about 95% of chronic disease, whether you talk about heart disease, dementia, mood disorders, gut disorders, anything you name, it is related to chronic inflammation. So what is chronic inflammation? Now, acute inflammation is, let us say you have a urinary tract infection, or you get a minor cut in your fingers, and then, you know, your immune system mounts a response and you have the immune system working well and that small little wound is healed. So that is an acute response. But what happens sometimes is that acute inflammatory response can remain there in your body in the background for a long time. So it's like, you know, a smoldering fire that is happening in the background. And you may not even know that is going on, but that is impacting your long-term health. So it's basically, you know, this is, again, a lot of fairly new information over the last several years. And everywhere you'll hear about chronic inflammation. The most important point here is, how will you know if you have chronic inflammation? So there are no blood tests for chronic inflammation. So Andrea, many people are shocked to know that there is no one single blood test which will tell us about chronic inflammation.
Exactly. I think we've been trained that if there's a problem, there's a blood test for it. And, yeah. And I think it is shocking to know that we don't have a test for chronic inflammation yet.
So here I need to explain this very clearly. So there is no one single blood test for chronic inflammation. But there are blood tests available for acute inflammation. One of them is called hsCRP, and another one is serum ferritin. These two tests are available anywhere in the world.
But, and we will have those in the show notes, so you don't have to scramble or panic.
But the thing is, these are actually markers of acute inflammation. If they remain high long-term, then we need to look at what are the sources of inflammation. Now, the next important thing is, Andrea, you had asked, how will someone know if they have inflammation?
Exactly.
One is, of course, doing the lab test, the blood test, the hsCRP and serum ferritin. The other is if you have a chronic inflammatory condition like, many of the autoimmune conditions like psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis, and there are 80 to 100 different autoimmune conditions, and there are some other autoinflammatory long-term conditions. So anyone who has those conditions, you know that there is, and again, with any condition like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis, you know that symptoms can flare up, and then they can, then you, depending on a lot of different things, then they can also reduce, and then they can, again, flare up for various reasons. So it's not like it remains constantly the same thing. So that is again something you know. You know that some of you actually know this very well, what causes a flare up as well. So in that kind of a situation, so when you have a flare up of any autoimmune condition, obviously your inflammation level at that point is high. But one thing which applies to, people everywhere, even if you don't have an autoimmune condition, is our food is one of the biggest sources of inflammation. Now, there are a lot of other causes as well, but I'm not going into all the other ones because food is one of the big ones. And in my world, we look at, dementia, heart disease. All of these are what we call a postprandial phenomena. Postprandial meaning after food. So for you to, for our, particularly for our hunter-gatherer ancestors, they didn't have, freezing or any of those things. And food didn't come completely sanitized. So obviously our immune systems had to be, had to work enough to know that if there are some infections, they have to be dealt with after we have the food. So just after eating food, some amount of inflammation is normal. But if that inflammation is too high, and again, it's not a simple test, there is something called LPS, lipopolysaccharide, which can be tested in blood, but most it's a research tool. It's not something I eat some food and I go to the lab and say, oh, I want you to check my LPS.
It's not a diagnostic. There is no
No.
one test. You're basically any test that we have for inflammation is really just information that we then deduce that there might be inflammation from the results. So it's not like a dipstick where you dip it in and say, yes, no, you have inflammation. You're more inferring that there might be inflammation. And of course, if you have something that is a chronic illness like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis or anything like that, that is a sign that there is inflammation in your body. So you know that already. And if you do have flare-ups of those or other things, then you also know that there's some inflammation. So inflammation is like a smoldering fire, and then it gets a little more oxygen and it can flare up. And so if food, which is one of the most common sources of inflammation, causes a flare up, you can start to track that. And also, I'm going to say probably stress may have an impact on that.
Oh,
But that's how you're going to identify that you do have inflammation. And then what steps can people take to reduce their levels of inflammation? And again, we will do a deep dive, but just overall, how can people reduce their inflammation levels?
as a functional medicine doctor, I always start with food first. So obviously, when it comes to food, as you rightly pointed out, Andrea, there is so much of information out there, and sometimes it gets very challenging for people to figure out what actually applies to them personally. So there are no generic recommendations for food. Each person is different. What food can, for example, I give the example of gluten. Now, gluten can be a problem for many people and increase inflammation levels. We'll do a deeper dive into gluten. So,
Exactly.
but for many people, eating gluten-containing food is not a problem at all. So saying that everyone needs to stop eating, whatever, whether it is gluten or grains or something, I feel is unfair because you need to find out whether that's really a problem for you. So food would be number one. And in functional medicine, we use something called an elimination diet. So there are some common food, culprits. Gluten is one of them. Obviously, sugar and simple carbohydrates are big ones. Then some people are sensitive to dairy. Again, some people are fine with, you know, cheese or, you know, yogurt, but they have a problem with milk. Again, it's not dairy as a whole group. Some people may be sensitive to some component of dairy, which can be very inflammatory to them. Others may not, may be absolutely fine with, you know, all of dairy. So that is why it's very difficult to give a generic recommendation. Each person needs to find out what their problem is. I had a patient recently, she came to me for, you know, some autoimmune condition, and one of the inflammatory markers. And I must also mention, I talked about hsCRP and ferritin. There are a whole lot of others which are not always tested, because Andrea, next time, you know, I'll find someone telling me, oh, you didn't talk about IL-6 and blah, blah, blah. And blah, blah.
Yes. And I think our listeners are like that. They really want the very specific information. Yeah. We're trying to distill it down in this episode to some high level bits, and then we'll go deeper into that. And of course, you can always reach out to Shabnam for some more information. So really, share with us about your client though.
So she was one of the other inflammatory markers were high, and both she, her, and I were trying to figure out what could it have been. And I said, you know what, you're off of gluten and you are feeling so much better. Why don't you look at dairy next? She said, oh, I love cheese and I love this. I said, you know what, how about giving it a shot for just 2 weeks? And what she found is, you know, 2 weeks she got off of all of dairy. And then, you know, in a month's time, she didn't reintroduce dairy. I said, no, you need to figure out which ones are your troublesome ones. Right. But in a month's time, she did her lab work again, and her inflammatory markers had come down. And she said, you know, I never realized it was the dairy. So, <Wow. laughs>
and it's amazing. And, you know, that this, again, you've said this, but this was for her. Gluten and dairy didn't work for her. It's not global advice. This is your body is an experiment for you. So you're going to see what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and get the help of a trusted medical professional that can help you sort that in a healthy way. For your client, gluten and dairy made her, eliminating those made her feel better and her markers came down. But for you listening, perhaps there'll be some other things. So definitely get some guidance, and Shabnam's here for you on that one. Any other final thoughts on chronic inflammation before we wrap up?
No, nothing else I think I want to add here, because we are going to do a deeper dive into chronic inflammation. And I think I will share more stories so that, you know, people can understand what it, you know, what would apply to them versus kind of like a science-y approach to it.
Exactly. And you know, I'll share personally that I have 2 children right now, but long ago I only had one, and I was trying to have another child and it wasn't happening. And I got the help of a medical professional. We sorted out some of the things. I ended up doing quick tests, eliminating gluten for a week, dairy for a week, a few other things, sugar, and then decided that I would eliminate all those on my own for a longer period of time, which I did. And to this day, I say that that period of time, I felt like I could rule the world. I had so much energy. I had so much clarity. I got so much done, and then I got pregnant. So, you might see, yeah. And so now I have 2 kids, they're older now, but that I've gone through, I know from doing my own experiments with a trusted medical healthcare provider, what it does for me. So don't underestimate, if you're listening, the power of looking at your food and addressing these issues. And I'm going to guess for me, that the food was the leverage to all those other things, right? So my blood glucose, inflammation went down, my blood glucose got better, my, you know, blood pressure, it was always fine. But all of those things probably got into the optimal range for me through that. And then I had a tremendous result. So you'll see what's right for you when you start experimenting with these 3 bits. So the 3 foundations are optimal blood glucose, optimal blood pressure, and low levels of chronic inflammation. So overall, when those are in line, you're at less risk for cognitive decline, heart disease, and you're going to have improved brain function, improved sleep, mood, energy, probably natural weight loss as well. So in the show notes, we'll have some deeper dive information, some support PDFs for you, and some tiny habit recipes so that you can take things further on your own. Definitely reach out to Dr. Shabnam for something more detailed and custom to you. And if you're moved, please review and rate. It really helps our reach so that we can help more people have optimal brain function. And with that, cheers.
Thank you.